Welcome to the Poem of the Week. Each week, our poems are intended to help you practice the best, most current medicine by alerting you to studies that could change your practice. As usual, our host this week is National Public Radio's Dr. Michael Wilkes and Essential Evidence Senior Editor Dr. Mark Abel. Gentlemen.
Hello, Mark. I hope you're doing okay.
Yeah, doing fine, Mike.
This week, we're going to return to a topic we've sort of followed on and off for a long time, which is acute pulmonary embolism. Listeners will know this is common, sometimes fatal. Wide variety of presenting symptoms, some from quite minor to some that are major shock and sudden death. Patients who have milder or non-specific symptoms can be asymptomatic. It's important that we have a high level of suspicion so that we don't miss cases. Patients can come in and we don't even think about PE. The most common symptoms in patients with PE, according to the POPED study, include things like dyspnea, pleuritic chest pain, cough, orthopnea, calf or thigh pain, wheezing, and hemoptysis. Those were in the order of their frequency. Our goal as clinicians is to estimate what we often call pretest probability for PE. And there's been a lot of study looking at sort of our clinical gestalt. We try to put patients into three categories, sort of a low probability, an intermediate probability, and a high probability. There have been a number of investigative teams that have come up with scoring criteria. Perhaps the best known is Wells' score. I think that the Wells team and others often complain that we don't use these scoring criteria quite as much as we can. There is another group called the Pulmonary Embolism Rule-Out Criteria Group, often abbreviated PERC, that was designed to identify patients with low clinical probability of PE, and the idea was to have them avoid unnecessary testing. There are 8 criteria for PERC, and maybe I'll just read them. They're available online. It's age less than 50, heart rate less than 100, oxyhemoglobin saturation greater than 95%, no hemoptysis, no estrogen use, no prior history of DVT or PE, no unilateral leg swelling, and no recent surgery. What role does the D-dimer have in all of this? It's best used in conjunction with clinical probability. And you found a poem. It was published toward the end of 2019. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. For those who want to follow along, it starts on page 2125. And it asks the question, can differing thresholds of D-dimer testing be used for patients with a low to moderate clinical pretest probability to help us rule out pulmonary embolism? Mark, it has the potential of being a useful study. What did they find, and is it useful?
Yeah, it is. I think it's it extends what we can do. And you know, what I like about clinical prediction rules is they help us focus our history and physical exam and then make the best use of it and not just provide kind of a one-size-fits-all care where you examine the patient, everybody gets a D-dimer, everybody gets an ultrasound, everybody gets a CT of the chest. That's over-testing, and it helps us be a little more efficient. Usually what we do with the clinical pretest probability using a validated rule like the Wells rule that you mentioned is used in conjunction with D-dimer testing. The current recommendations from the Wells group and others are that patients with a low clinical probability and a D-dimer less than 500 are low enough risk that you can essentially rule out PE. So this study looks at whether you can use a somewhat broader definition of low risk. So they found ED in outpatient clinic patients with suspected PE. They used the Wells rule to estimate probability of PE. And by the way, if you have essential evidence, plus the Wells rule, the PERC, the PISA, the several others are all in our clinical prediction rule registry. We have about 500 clinical prediction rules that are interactive. You can use on your phone, et cetera. So patients with a low pretest probability and a D-dimer less than 1,000, as well as those with a moderate probability and D-dimer less than 500 were deemed low risk. So essentially, they used two separate D-dimer. They were used a tighter cutoff of less than 500 for the moderate risk folks and a looser one of 1,000 for the low risk folks. And those were low risk patients, did not get anticoagulants, didn't get any further testing. Everyone else who didn't fit those criteria got CT pulmonary angiography or a VQ scan. And if a PE was diagnosed, they were anticoagulated. And then they followed everybody up in 3 months to see had anyone experienced VTE during that 3-month period. So what they found was that 87% could be classified as a low clinical probability by those criteria, 11% moderate, and 2.3% high probability. The bottom line is that for those with a low clinical probability and a D-dimer less than 1,000, and those with a moderate probability and D-dimer less than 500, there were a total of 1,325 patients. None of them had VTE at 3 months. And it decreased the amount of chest imaging needed from 52% down to 34%. So two-thirds of patients didn't require chest imaging, which, you know, has radiation, which has its own, which is cost, which is more time in the ED. And so I think it's generally a good strategy. The bottom line is strategy that raises the D-dimer cutoff to 1,000 for those with low probability based on the Wells rule, and then uses a 500 cutoff for moderate risk patients appears to be safe and is basically in the three-month follow-up, they didn't see any VTEs in that group. It also reduces imaging studies and radiation and cost.
It does seem exactly the kind of research that we need to help us avoid unnecessary stays and length and all the things that you've said, cost and radiation. My favorite question to ask you is, how do you get something like this that seems to be a big sample? It seems to be a well-done study. How do you change doctors' behavior?
It's tough. And, you know, sometimes the incentives aren't lined up. I think we certainly have an incentive now with COVID-19 increasingly widespread in the U.S. to get patients in and out of the ED as quickly and efficiently as possible, to not tie up CT scanners that might be required for patients with suspected COVID-19 infection. So there are incentives now that may not have been there to, you know, use things like this that can make us more efficient, get patients out of the ED more quickly. One of my colleagues who ran the residency here, the internal medicine residency here, would, if anybody tried to present a patient with suspected PE and didn't know the Wells score, they were sent back to calculate it. So, you know, a lot of that has to do with training and how we get used to using this information.
I mean, your points are excellent. As we think more aggressively about how to use the EMR, if we have a constellation of two or three of these symptoms, it can then ask you to calculate the Wells criteria and get the missing data. And so if you're not thinking of it, make sure that it's on your differential diagnosis.
That's right. Yeah.
Thanks, Mark. We'll talk again next week.
Sounds good.
Well, that's this week's poem. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to read this and other recent poems, please go to www.essentialevidence.com. And please join us again next week for another medical poem.